welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, a centennial perspective on the Nova Rupta Katmai eruption of 1912, the largest eruption of the 20th century. Hosted by the U.S. Geological Survey, the National Park Service, and the Alaska History Society, USGS research geologist Judy Feirstein's talk on the Nova Rupta Katmai eruption of 1912 was recorded on April 24th at the Anchorage Museum.
Well, thank you very much, everyone, for coming out tonight. My name is Tina Neal. I work for the U.S. Geological Survey, the Alaska Volcano Observatory. On behalf of the U.S. Geological Survey, the National Park Service, and the Alaska Historical Society, I'd like to welcome you to the first of many commemorative events this year that are honoring the 100th anniversary of the great Nova Rupta Katmai eruption. And so tonight we are really honored and pleased to have the world's expert on this eruption here to speak to us. Judy Feirstein is a research geologist from the U.S. Geological Survey's office in Menlo Park, California. And as I said, she is the expert on everything to do with the 1912 eruption. In particular, she has been spending the last 30 plus years of her career deciphering the incredible details of the placement of the hot pumice and ash flow, which gave rise to the Valley of 10,000 Smokes that hopefully many of you have seen or at least seen pictures of. Tonight we'll hear about some of that work and how she interleaved understanding of that ash flow with a very complex sequence of ash fall layers and the eyewitness accounts to reconstruct a lot of the elegant details of this really dramatic eruption 100 years ago. A little bit more about Judy. She joined the U.S. Geological Survey in 1980, just before the Mount St. Helens eruption. It was a very famous incident for many of us, and she began working in Katmai later that summer. I think she's probably spent cumulatively maybe as much as a year of her life out in the valley and around the Katmai volcanoes, mostly backpacking and tent camping, doing this geologic field work and in the typical Katmai weather that many of you know so well. She's a hardy soul. I want to point out that in about a month, Judy and her colleague Wes Hildreth, who was accompanying her on much of the work out in the valley, are publishing a U.S. Geological Survey professional paper, which will be a beautifully illustrated book on the 1912 eruption, many facets of the eruption. So watch our website for announcement when that will be available. In addition to Judy's work out at Katmai and understanding the eruptive history of all the Katmai volcanoes, she's managed to do work on many of the Cascade volcanoes in the lower 48, and also work on the eruptive history of volcanoes in the high Andes of South America. She's also an accomplished mountaineer, having climbed Aconcagua and the North Peak of Mount Everest, among others. She has graduate and undergraduate degrees from the University of California at Santa Cruz, and has received many awards in her career, and she's also been named a Fellow of the Geological Society of America. So we're really pleased that Judy took the time out of her pre-field season schedule to come up, and we're really happy she's here. After tonight, she's going on to Fairbanks for a couple of more lectures, and then in the very fitting conclusion, she'll be in Kodiak on Thursday to give a lecture at the Baranof Museum. And as many of you know, Kodiak was ground zero for more than a foot of ash fall during the 1912 eruption, so I know they're looking forward to her visit. So after Judy's talk, there'll be some time for questions, and I'm really pleased to see such a good turnout. I'll turn it over to Judy.
It's always hard to get used to an introduction like that. Well, 32 years ago, I just graduated from college. I went to the USGS and I knocked on doors looking for a summer geology job. I focused mostly on what we then called the Alaska branch, just because I really wanted to go to Alaska. Doesn't everybody? The call I got back was from Wes Hildreth, and the plan was not for Alaska, but to help map Mount Adams, a volcano in Washington State, about 45 miles due east of Mount St. Helens. I began working at the USGS in March. 2 months later, May 18th, 1980, Mount St. Helens erupted. It was a big one. We volcanologists call this a Plinian eruption, and a Plinian eruption column. It went 12 miles high and sent ash beyond Wyoming, which also covered Mount Adams, of course. And the Forest Service closed all access roads to that volcano for the summer. So just by lucky circumstance, the effects from one Plinian eruption started me on a career to work on another, even bigger one. Instead of Mount Adams, we went to a place that Wes had just begun to explore, the Valley of 10,000 Smokes in Katmai National Park, and I ended up in Alaska after all. Well, 5 months into my new job, we flew from San Francisco to Anchorage and on to King Salmon on one of those rare clear days where I could see every snow-covered peak on the way. We took a float plane to King Salmon, from King Salmon to Brooks Camp. We walked to the falls and we saw the bears fishing. That was well before the viewing platform. And caught the 23-mile ride to what's called the Overlook Cabin at the end of the road in the Katmai Park. And from there, we had a wonderful view up the Valley of 10,000 Smokes toward Mount Katmai, and I looked over where we would be spending our next 6 weeks. That was a summer of many firsts for me. I still don't know why Wes ever decided to take such a greenhorn to a place like Katmai, but it was the beginning of a lifelong friendship and a very productive working partnership. It was my first ever backpacking trip. It was the first expedition I had ever planned. We brought everything with us that we would need for those 6 weeks, like peanut butter, crackers, cookies, and freeze-dried food. No showers, just the two of us. Our special treat were sea rations, for those who remember what those are. And we would look forward to them once a week when we hiked back to the Overlook Cabin to resupply. It was also my first time crossing rivers where you could see the glaciers that fed them. It was the first time I'd been in wind so fierce that I couldn't stand up. I could only turn my back to the sand-blasted and wind-driven pumice it picked up off the ground. What a place. Well, I'm sure that the early explorers said the same thing. Yet they, as did we, came back again and again. Why? Well, there's great intrigue about the place. The event that created the Valley of 10,000 Smokes in Katmai Caldera was the most voluminous of the 20th century. It exploded on the 6th through the 8th of June, 1912, from a new volcano, later named Nova Rupta. Volcanic ash, more than from all other historical eruptions in Alaska combined, devastated areas hundreds of miles away, and the huge eruption column rose so high that stratospheric winds carried the ash around the world. The great eruption of 1912 lasted for 3 days, and it focused scientific attention on the hot ash flows that caused the 10,000 smokes. But its significance for the developing science of volcanology involved a lot more than size alone. For a century ago, the field of volcanology was in its infancy. Many things from this eruption had never been seen before, and they weren't very well understood. Subsequent research there has taught us a lot about the processes and hazards associated with such large explosive events. And now, 100 years later, we look carefully at that event and consider what would happen if a similar one erupted today. Well, tonight we'll look mostly at not only what happened during those 3 days in 1912, but also how they managed to remain scientifically important for 100 years, and why the 1912 deposits continue in the 21st century to provide insights about volcanic and magmatic processes that impact us and the land in which we live. Well, let's begin by going back to the 6th of June, 1912. It started as a pretty normal Thursday. The mail steamer Dora was making its usual mail run from Uyak to Kodiak. If there was anything unusual about the day, in the often overcast Shelikof Strait on the Alaska Peninsula, it's that the ship traveled up the strait all morning under clear skies on a fine day. They'd already made the turn toward Kodiak when Captain C.B. McMullen and his crew heard a very big explosion. Looking back toward the Alaska Peninsula, they saw a rising eruption column from the direction of Katmai Volcano. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. This column rose quickly and it spread rapidly, overtaking the vessel by 3 or 4 in the afternoon. Ash began falling on deck by 6 in the evening, and the ship was enveloped in complete darkness. The air, thick with hot ash, was stifling. Rather than risk landing at Kodiak, Captain McMullen decided to continue on to the open ocean. He said that thunder and lightning had begun early in the afternoon, and that helpless birds of all species kept falling on the deck, floundering and crying wildly. The cloud quickly reached an altitude of 20 miles, and within 4 hours from a huge volcanic eruption sent ash on the village of Kodiak, 100 miles to the southeast of the volcanic vent. The towering cloud was seen for hundreds of miles, and it rose so high that it was carried around the world by stratospheric winds. By the end of the eruption, 3 days later on June 9th, the ash cloud, now thousands of miles across, shrouded southern Alaska and western Canada, and sulfurous ash was falling on Vancouver, BC, and Seattle, Washington. The next day, the cloud passed over Virginia, and by June 17th, it reached Algeria and Africa. This great quantity of ash caused unusually brilliant sunsets, and by shielding the sun's rays, lowered the Earth's temperature for about 2 degrees Fahrenheit or so in the Northern Hemisphere for more than a year. During the 3 days of that eruption, June 6th, 7th, and 8th, falling ash and sulfur dioxide gas immobilized the population of Kodiak. It was dark. Many complained of sore eyes and breathing problems. Water became undrinkable. With radio communications totally disrupted and visibility near zero, so ships couldn't dock, the people of Kodiak were totally cut off. Roofs in Kodiak collapsed under the weight of more than a foot of ash. Buildings were wrecked by ash avalanches that rushed down from nearby hill slopes, and other structures burned after being struck by lightning from the ash cloud. Similar conditions prevailed elsewhere in southern Alaska, and several villages were abandoned forever. Ash and acid rain affected more than just the people. Bears and other large animals were blinded by ash and starved because the plants that they ate and the small animals that they ate were wiped out. Millions of dead birds were blinded. They were coated by volcanic ash and littered the ground. Mussels, insect larvae, kelp, and the fish that fed upon all of those died from the ash-choked water. Alaska's salmon fishing industry was devastated, especially from 1915 to 1919, because of the starvation and the failure of many of the adult fish to spawn in the ash-choked waters of 1912. Well, clearly, the effects of the 1912 eruption were far-reaching and caught people's attention. George C. Martin of the U.S. Geological Survey interviewed many eruption refugees just a month after the big event. And he compiled comprehensive account of the eruption impacts on both sides of Shelikof Strait. He heard villagers' reports of strong earthquakes felt as much as 5 days before the eruption that prompted them to leave their homes near the volcano before June 6. So no one died from the eruption. But no one knew what had happened in the immediate vicinity of the volcano either. No living thing survived near the vent itself. Not until 4 years later did Robert F. Griggs, outfitted by the National Geographic Society, hike across Katmai Pass to the heart of the eruption area, where he discovered and named Novarupta, meaning newly erupted. The thousands of columns of steam that he aptly called the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, and the awe-inspiring Katmai Caldera. As Griggs began to publicize his discoveries, the world learned that an eruption of historic proportions had occurred in this remote region of Alaska. Though most of the smokes have now died out, the fascination that the Valley of 10,000 Smokes holds for geologists and adventurers of all kinds has continued since Griggs's day. Well, Understanding the significance of the 1912 eruption first requires a step back to see a bigger picture. For although this explosive eruption of Nova Rupta made the Katmai region famous, it's hardly alone in the area. Nova Rupta, Katmai, and the five other nearby volcanoes are all part of the Aleutian Volcanic Arc. It's the curving chain of volcanoes that extend from south central Alaska to the far western end of the Aleutian Islands. It's one of the most active volcanic regions in the world, and it's only one of a series of volcanic chains that ring the Pacific Ocean. This Pacific Ring of Fire marks the boundaries of the shifting plates that make up the Earth's crust. Great stresses accumulate along these boundaries, and the plates move past each other, and the resulting strain has long been linked to seismic and magmatic activity. These stresses continue today, which is why so many of the volcanoes are still active. Well, the magnitude and volume of the eruption of Nova Rupta in 1912 were exceptional, far larger than any other historical eruption anywhere in North America. And in addition, there are several other things about this eruption that have contributed to its uniqueness and made this a jewel in the volcanological world. They compelled researchers to continue to come here for 100 years. So number one, for the first time in recorded history, a great explosive eruption deposited its pyroclastic flows, that is, the mixtures of hot ash and gas and pumice, on the land instead of at sea, as had happened at Krakatoa in 1883. So for the first time, they could be studied in detail. In fact, it was Griggs's fascination with the steaming valley, the 10,000 smokes, that led President Wilson to preserve Katmai National Monument in 1918. Griggs called them a wonder of the world and thought that they would rival Yellowstone's geysers for years to come. Well, the second unique thing is that it was also one of the few places where it was recognized that a whole range of magma compositions erupted together. Now, magma, simply the term used for liquid lava before it erupts, contained different amounts of the element silica. Gas dissolved in the magma at depth bursts out violently when the magma reaches the Earth's surface, blowing it apart into bits of ash and froth. It's just like releasing the lid to a shaken up soda bottle. The froth, in this case, is the pumice. The different types of pumice are easily recognized here. The white pumice with few mineral crystals is rhyolite, and it has the most silica. Only a few historical eruptions have produced such large volumes of rhyolite. In the next in line is the white pumice with a lot of crystals, and that's dacite, and that has somewhat less silica. The black pumice with a lot of crystals is andesite. That has the least amount of silica. And when they come out of the vent, all at the same time, the magmas swirl together like marble cake to create white and black banded pumice. This unusual occurrence began debates in the geologic community in 1912 about how these different magmas could all be in one erupting system. Well, the third thing so unique about this eruption is that the vent from which it came is still largely preserved. This is so unusual because in most large eruptions, the magma erupts directly above its underground holding chamber. It erupts and the ground collapses because there's nothing supporting it anymore. The vent area is destroyed and it leaves behind a collapsed depression called a caldera. When the early investigators, Clarence Fenner and Robert Griggs, first reached the summit of Katmai Caldera in 1916, the cliffs that surround the summit crater lake were fresh and glacier-free, and vigorous gas jets or fumaroles ringed the caldera floor. In 1923, there wasn't even a lake there. No wonder they thought that Katmai was the vent for the eruption. Even now, although the caldera is filled with an 800-foot-deep lake, it's still impressive. Many decades passed before Garnes Curtis, in 1953, set the record straight about the eruption, most importantly establishing that the vent, where everything came out, was Nova Rupta, not Mount Katmai, as Fenner and Griggs had previously supposed. His work clearly showed that although Mount Katmai did collapse during the eruption, because most of the magma had been stored beneath it, almost all of the magma vented at Nova Rupta, 6 miles away. Well, this configuration, where the place where the magma is stored, the magma chamber, so far from where it erupted, is very unusual. Understanding the underground conditions or the plumbing system that enabled this spurred debate that continues today. Over the last 3 decades, detailed studies of Nova Rupta deposits have contributed to a better understanding of how volcanoes work, how explosive pumice and ash get erupted and deposited, how calderas collapse, and what was happening at the vent itself during that 3-day eruption. Although no one could have survived from anywhere close by, volcanologists pieced together what happened through detailed observations of the deposits that are left behind. The unique situation with the caldera collapse, separate from the eruptive vent, provide an ideal opportunity for such studies because nowhere else do young deposits from such a big eruption provide a geologic record right up to the vent itself. Well, I showed you this photo at the beginning of the talk. This is a Plinian column from the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens. One like this exploded out of Nova Rupta and jetted skyward with little interruption for about 60 hours. Well, we don't have any photos of that eruption column, but I included this one to give you a sense of the power of such an event. Consider that the 1912 eruption was 30 times larger. The mixture of hot pumice and ash and volcanic gas erupted at supersonic speeds. This Plinian column is from Pinatubo, which erupted only 21 years ago. It was bigger than St. Helens, but still half the volume of Nova Rupta. But you can see in the photo with the arrows that I've drawn that here, as at Nova Rupta, so much came out of the vent at once that the ejecta went up, down, and out all at the same time. As the central part went up, the margins of the Plinian column collapsed. The collapsing part flooded the vent area, flowing down the surrounding valleys. At Nova Rupta, these ash flows, or pyroclastic flows, filled the valleys as deep as 600 feet and remained hot for several decades. The 10,000 smokes are named for the many steaming cracks and fissures where surface waters that entered the hot deposits were expelled as steam. Some of the ejecta went out, never a part of the high plume, but rather they were just hurled out of the way on a ballistic trajectory. This one, a lot bigger than me, is over 0.5 miles from the vent. And then ash and pumice in the central part of the Plinian column went way up and were distributed widely by the regional and stratospheric winds, and they were deposited as ash fall. The fallout accumulates thickly near the vent. It's nearly 40 feet thick here, about 2.5 miles northeast of Nova Rupta. The layering that you see reflects the accumulation of pumice bit by bit over time. Some of the pronounced lines you see, however, reflect changing conditions at the vent, with some starts and stops in the eruption. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Notice that the individual clasts in the fall deposit here are large, some nearly head-sized, relative to here, about 7 miles further away, where the same deposit, also layered, is less than 3 feet thick, and the ash is much finer, more like beach sand. Well, ash thickness and ash and pumice sizes are important ways we characterize these deposits, and then we compare them from one place to another in areas near and far from their source. So as you've seen already, the ash was widely distributed. And in order to measure its thickness far from the vent, I hired a fishing boat for 2 summers looking for ash on both sides of Shelikof Strait. And thanks to Captain Eric Stirrup and First Mate Hank Pennington, we made it there and back again in spite of some stormy weather. Those thicknesses and the ones that we measure near the vent are compiled on this map, where the distribution of the ash is shown by the red lines. Nova Rupta is the yellow star. Each line represents where the ash is the same thickness, an isopach, and everything within the line is at least that thick. These isopachs are elongate, and they reflect that the wind strongly blew the ash southeastward. You can see the 30-centimeter isopach, that's about a foot of ash, includes Kodiak 100 miles southeast of Nova Rupta. Using the distribution pattern and the thickness of the ash, we can calculate that the 3-day eruption produced just over 7 cubic miles of pumice and ash. If that were compressed back into the dense magma without the gas, that would be about 3 cubic miles of magma. That's about enough to cover the municipality of Anchorage with magma 1.5 miles thick. Well, that's a lot of magma. But it didn't come out all at once. And we know that in part from the people on Kodiak, because they reported that the heaviest ash fall came in 3 periods over the 3 days. We call them episodes 1, 2, and 3. And I'm sure that after each one, the folks in Kodiak were hoping it was all over. But there were never more than a few hours break between each. Now remember, the Dora spotted the eruption column at 1 p.m. on the 6th of June. But it took several hours for the ash to reach Kodiak. So with the time of day in the middle of the diagram, you can see that the 3 periods of ash fall on Kodiak were about 4 hours later than the corresponding eruptions at the vent. So ash was falling at Kodiak between about 5 p.m. on June 6th and 9 in the morning on June 7th. Ash started falling again at noon and fell until about 2:30 in the afternoon the next day. And the third ash fall began in the evening of June 8th, but the day dawned clear on June 9th. Well, there are many details to this eruptive sequence, but the 3 notable things shown here are 1, each episode includes 2 to 3 fall layers called layers A through H. They were first named by Curtis. And number 2, nearly all the flows, that is, those that fill the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, erupted during the first episode. So they were over by 9 a.m. on June 7th. And number 3 is that episodes 2 and 3 were largely fallout. They had no large ash flows. Well, in this aerial photo, if you know what to look for, you can see a good deal of the general eruption story. You're looking about southeast towards Shelikof Strait and Kodiak Island, right along the main downwind axis for the fallout distribution. Episode 1 began with a bang, actually a big blast, that plastered all the near vent hill slopes that you see with high energy ash flows. It was during this first eruptive phase that the volume and rate at which the pumice and ash were ejected were so great that some of it went upward into the towering eruption column and became ashfall, and some of it flooded the vent as ash flows. Episode 1 left a 1.25 mile wide depression filled with pumice and ash from its own eruption. I've circled it in yellow. Fault scarps caused by collapse and subsidence in 1912 included the near vertical face of Falling Mountain on the right, and they encircle the area that was the vent for the first day of the eruption. By the time that first phase was over, nearly 5 cubic miles of new pumice and ash filled the surrounding valleys and covered the landscape. Nearly half of what was erupted was deposited as fallout that covered the entire region, and just over half was deposited as ash flows that were largely confined to the surrounding valleys. Well, within this larger vent, the subsequent eruptions bored through the already partly consolidated deposits of episode 1. Through a smaller vent that produced the ash falls of the next 2 days. Nearly all of the 2 cubic miles that erupted during this time was dispersed as regional fallout. There were minor ash flows, but they didn't go very far. These eruptions, episodes 2 and 3, also built a ring of pumice-rich ejecta around their smaller vent, which we informally call the turtle. I've put that in the pale yellow. And in the end, when all the explosive activity was over and the people in Kodiak could finally breathe again, the last bit of magma was extruded out of the vent as the Novarupta lava dome. Well, we go back to this diagram, which shows the sequence of events as represented by the different fall layers, layers A through H, that accumulated one on top of the other throughout the three eruptive episodes. Now remember the photos of the Plinian columns we saw earlier. Imagine the wind, the noise, and the chaos that must have overwhelmed anything around the vent. The lulls in the falling ash on Kodiak were actual breaks in the eruption when the big column stopped. And it was only then was it calm enough for fine ash to settle near the vent. The gray bands in the diagram labeled E and H are the fine dust that accumulated near the vent during those relatively quieter times. Once after episode two, and again after episode three, when the big eruption was over. Those fine ash layers, the arrows point to them in the photograph, are distinctive, and they were important markers for us as we put together this eruption sequence. Well, by now, I've given you a general overview of the sequence of events. But in order to decipher what was happening at the vent during the eruption, we have to look very carefully at the surrounding deposits. In the field, we sieve these, and we characterize their grain size, and we establish the proportions of the different pumice types. The key to understanding the sequence of events relies on being able to distinguish the different pumice types from one another. And we talked about these before, the rhyolite, the dacite, and the andesite. Although they were ejected together during much of the eruption, their relative proportions varied with time. These variations were used to track the dispersal, the character, and the thickness of each layer, both around the vent and in more distal locations. And that information was used to piece together what happened during those 3 days in 1912. So, not only can we put the episodes into a real time frame by using the recorded ash at Kodiak, but we can connect the fallout on Kodiak with what was erupting at the vent by comparing the composition of the ash and pumice in both places. Well, because this compositional sequence was so important in the detective work that went into figuring out what happened during the eruption, we'll take a look at it now. Episode one began with widespread dispersal of purely rhyolitic fallout, layer A, and contemporaneous all rhyolite ash flows. After a few hours, andesite and dacite magma joined in. That's the R plus D plus A, marking the beginning of layer B. And in this photo, about 3 miles southeast of the vent, the fallout is interlayered with ash flows in both the all rhyolite and the mixed portion. The 16 inches of compositionally mixed fall and flow here represents the same interval here. It's the same time interval, about 10 miles in the opposite direction. This is in the lower part of the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, where most of the ash flows accumulated. Looking a little more closely, pumice proportions in fallout layer B change from more than 99% rhyolite at its base to only about 15% at its top, matching the progressive shifts in the pumice proportions in the main sequence of the ash flow pulses or packages in place concurrently in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. And the color change in the ash flows shows up well here. By 9 a.m. on June 7th, ash flow emplacement was all over, and ash fall stopped at Kodiak for a short time. So we know that episode one lasted about 16 hours and produced all of the Valley of 10,000 Smokes ash flow. That's 2.6 cubic miles, and roughly half of the fall deposits. It's just over 2 cubic miles. So we move on to episodes two and three, which were similar to one another. Each began after an eruptive lull. then erupted from the smaller vent that we saw before inside the larger one of episode one, and each deposited widespread fault layers, here layers C, D, and F, G, which were almost entirely dacite. Layer E is the fine ash that settled between the two eruptive episodes. Well, in contrast to episode one, which produced the big ash flows of the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, almost all of the volume of deposits from these two episodes are widespread fallout. But notice the finer grained layer that separates layer C from D. That thin layer here, 2.5 miles from the vent, is just the fine dust that got winnowed out of small ash flows that the arrows point to that erupted at the same time as the fall, but they never made it out of near the vent area. These small ash flow deposits are seen there, and Novarupta's at the top to give you a sense of how close it is to the vent. So it's these ash flows in the area around Novarupta that showed that the vent remained unsettled even when residents of Kodiak were hoping their ordeal was over, because these were in place when the fine ash had a chance to settle further away. So these sorts of details are only preserved because most of the collapse occurred at Mount Katmai and not here. Other details that are preserved in the deposits near the vent have enabled us to connect the eruption of the compositionally variable fall deposits during eruption one with their compositionally similar flow deposits that were erupted at the same time. So by counting the types of pumice in the deposits, we can correlate the fall and the flow deposits with one another, even though in character they look pretty different. And we can correlate deposits near the vent with those further away. For the first time, it was documented unequivocally that a big Plinian eruption column could produce both fall and flow deposits at the same time. Previous ideas that the entire column would have to collapse in order to produce big ash flows were shown to be incorrect. So the same synchronous fall-flow relationship has now been documented in other places too, which changes how we view potential hazards from such an event. This diagram summarizes the changing pumice proportions in the pumice types throughout episode one. The flow deposits are on the left, and the fall deposits are on the right. And the colors on the left represent the changing proportions of pumice types in the ash flow deposits. They're 100% pure rhyolite at the bottom with progressively less rhyolite toward the top, just like the fall deposits. Well, the Valley of 10,000 Smokes was once thought to be the prime example of plug flow in placement of an ash flow, essentially a big wall of pumice and ash moving sluggishly together down the valley. Now that's what I learned in my basic geology class, although that was a while ago. This is an aerial view northwestward, and you can see the pink ash flow deposit all the way down the valley. This photo in the lower valley, where you can see the pink ash flow deposit banked against an older ridge that stopped the flow, and the flow was then diverted around the ridge. The pink wedge here is the very edge of that ash flow deposit against the ridge, and it's easy to see why it was first thought to be just one mass of moving material. But by using the pumice proportions in the deposits, we can actually map the distribution of the different pulses of flows that came out of the vent to build, over time, the accumulation of the total thickness of the ash flow deposit. So the colors on these maps are the same as in that previous diagram. The maps show that the first all rhyolite flows, we call them package one, in the upper left were the most energetic. You can see that by the somewhat circular, circular distribution pattern. And as subsequent flows filled the old river valleys, each sequential flow package preferentially followed low areas where preceding flows had already compacted. So the Valley of 10,000 Smokes was not emplaced en masse, but rather it was filled by 9 sequential pulses of ash flows. And by using the timing of the fallout at Kodiak, the fall stratigraphy, and seismic records, we know that these ash flows were all deposited within the first 16 hours of the three-day event. Well, we've talked about episodes 1, 2, and 3, and these explosive episodes were followed by extrusion of 3 lava domes. Compared to the explosive violence of June 6th through 9th, the growth of these domes wasn't much more than a magmatic afterthought. After all, the gas was gone, and it slowly squeezed out of the vent, somewhat like a tube of toothpaste. Though the exact timing isn't known, the domes likely formed within days or as long as a year after the Plinian events. It was there already by the time Griggs saw it in 1916. One small dacite lava dome that plugged the episode 3 vent was destroyed by small explosions. We call it the Phantom Dome. All that remains are lava blocks like the upper photo in the upper right, scattered on the surface on top of layer H. The same vent was plugged again by the rhyolite Novarupta Dome, which remains today. The third one is a dacite dome extruded on the floor of Katmai Caldera. It's the only new magma that came out of the Katmai Caldera in 1912. Fortunately, it was photographed by Griggs in 1916 because it's now covered by that caldera lake. Well, many aspects of that three-day explosive eruption at Novarupta in 1912 focused attention on this remote volcano, and it's become one of the most intensively studied in the world. At any time, such an eruption would attract a lot of attention. But in 1912, the field of volcanology was in its infancy. Phenomena not previously seen or recognized anywhere else provided opportunities for a wide range of research. In addition to the aspects already discussed, the eruption also led to pioneering studies of the 10,000 smokes themselves. Well, first, Griggs and his team were quite wary of these hissing curls of steam. By 1919, however, the territory had become more familiar, and they learned to position their camp around just the right fumaroles to bake their cornbread and fry their bacon. No freeze-dried food for them. Well, notice how he's holding that long stick with one hand. He can do that because the steam was coming out of the fumarole vent fast enough that it buoyed up the frying pan. Griggs tells the story that one out-of-control frying pan flipped the bacon in the air, sending the hungry men scattering to collect the bacon before they fell on the ashy ground. And from his telling, this turned into a repeated game of bacon catch. Well, no talk about the Valley of 10,000 Smokes is complete without this photograph of Father Hubbard, the glacier priest from the University of Santa Clara, who visited the Valley in 1929 with 4 college boys and 2 dogs. He called the steaming valley the abomination of desolation, and he didn't want to take any chances with his dogs. Well, on a more serious note, Sayre and Hegelbarger, Griggs's students at Ohio State, joined Griggs's team, and they measured fumarole temperatures from boiling to 645 degrees centigrade. That's nearly 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. Studies of the mineral deposits around the fumaroles were important in understanding high-temperature vapor transport as it applied to metallic ore deposition, which was an important topic of debate at the time. Well, fumaroles in the ash flows persisted for about a decade, and those closer to the vent lasted a little longer. There were still warm spots when I went there in 1980. And now all that's left of the smokes are these fossil fumaroles, the brightly colored mineral deposits along linear cracks where steam once rose in consolidated ash flow deposits. And aureoles of color around where the steam vents were in the fallout. Well, there are many more lessons learned from a century of studies at Novarupta. The last one for tonight is one of my favorites, for it requires bringing together many lines of evidence all at once. Things we've already looked at tonight, combined with earthquake records, to understand better how calderas collapse. The reasoning goes like this. We combine what we know about the fallout stratigraphy, layers A through H on the left, with the ash flow stratigraphy, the 9 flow packages on the right, and we tie them together with their pumice type proportions. And we've learned that the fall deposits here along the Shelikof Strait erupted at the same time as ash flow deposits here in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. We combine what we know about ash fall timing in Kodiak along the bottom of the slide, and we compare that timing with earthquake records. The major earthquakes are shown by the red stars. There were many earthquakes associated with this eruption, beginning 5 days before the ash started falling. The first major one, however, was just before midnight on the 6th of June, about 11 hours after the eruption began, and that's what marked the onset of caldera collapse. Now, there's one more piece of evidence we need to put this all together, and that's what we call the Katmai mud layers. Although almost no new magma came out of Katmai in 1912, there were explosions that accompanied its collapse. Several muddy, block-rich layers expelled during these explosions are found in between the fall deposits, layers A through H, that came out of Nova Rupta. So on the right is an exposure of such a layer. It's nearly 40 feet thick here, right on the rim of Katmai caldera. These layers thin away from Katmai, where the fall layers A through H thin away from Nova Rupta. Now these, I call them mud layers, but they actually are full of a lot of blocks that are just the old parts of Katmai volcano that got broken up with the explosion and the collapse. The size of the blocks in the deposits gets smaller away from their respective sources too. So that's what's shown at the top. Blocks that came out with explosions from Katmai get smaller away from the caldera, and blocks that ejected with fall layers A through G get smaller away from Nova Rupta. Well, the mud layers from explosions at Katmai coincide with earthquakes as the caldera collapsed piecemeal. See the big stars. So as Nova Rupta exploded and Katmai collapsed, there were 14 earthquakes of magnitude 6 to 7 felt around the region. So because we can see the Katmai layers interlayered with the Nova Rupta fallout, we know the Katmai caldera collapsed fitfully in pieces as the magma beneath it erupted at Nova Rupta. Well, investigations continue today with recent work using state-of-the-art analytical instruments that measure things as small as bubbles of fluid trapped in individual crystals in pumices. These tell us how hot the magma was and at what depth the magma was stored before erupting. Other investigations consider a larger scale, like those that examine how seismic waves generated by earthquakes travel through subsurface areas beneath volcanoes. These provide underground images of where and how the magma was stored. Each new study uses previous work as a foundation. The focus on understanding the 1912 eruption and its products has led to significant advances in understanding volcanic and magmatic processes. What makes volcanoes erupt? And it's changed the way scientists think about large explosive eruptions. Well, a Nova Rupta scale eruption is almost certain to happen again in Alaska. The question is only when. Although the chance of another eruption of this magnitude occurring in any given year is small, such cataclysmic volcanic events have occurred repeatedly in Alaska. This one at Kogoyak erupted about 6,000 years ago in what is now the northeast corner of Katmai National Park. It too left a caldera filled by a lake. Picturesque Aniakchak caldera formed during a similar, though larger, catastrophic eruption about 3,500 years ago. Within 500 miles of Anchorage, volcanologists have identified at least 7 deposits of volcanic ash younger than 6,000 years that approach or exceed the volume of ash ejected by Nova Rupta in 1912, including a layer of ash erupted from Hayes Volcano only 90 miles northwest of Anchorage. Well, only about 50,000 people lived in Alaska in 1912, and there were no airplanes. Now, nearly 750,000 people live in the state, and aircraft carrying many thousands of passengers and millions of dollars in cargo pass near Alaska's more than 40 historically active volcanoes every day. The heavy ashfall produced by a Nova Rupta scale eruption occurring today in southern Alaska would bring the state's economy to a standstill, and it would have economic and environmental impacts in Alaska and beyond. Fortunately, though, we've learned a lot over the years from studying this and other eruptions. The Alaska Volcano Observatory, a cooperative effort of the USGS, the University of Alaska, and the State Survey, is helping to minimize the effects of volcanic eruptions on Alaskan communities. We do hazards assessments and closely monitor the volcanoes for any signs of unrest so that timely warning can be given of impending eruptions. So, in this centennial year, we commemorate the great eruption of 1912. Ongoing studies continue to improve our understanding of volcanoes, magmatism, and how those interact with our society today. There's room now more than ever for enthusiastic new researchers, and volcanoes in Alaska and elsewhere provide a beautiful and dynamic natural laboratory. Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Judy Feirstein, research geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Her talk, entitled The Nova Rupta Katmai Eruption of 1912, the Largest Eruption of the 20th Century, a Centennial Perspective, was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on April 24th. Following Judy's presentation, she responded to questions from the audience.
The question is, Griggs was a botanist, and why was he sent rather than a geologist? People didn't really know about volcanic eruptions like this at the time, and they were very concerned about the revegetation of the area. So that's what Griggs went to study. In fact, he went to Kodiak first, and he did study that and did publish a lot about the revegetation of the area. He brought with him other people with a little more experience pertinent to the volcanoes, but really there weren't a lot of people at the time who did that kind of study at all. Yes. There are different, the question is, what is a Plinian eruption? It's a size designation, really, and it's based on how small the pieces are and how far they went. And there's a whole classification scheme, Plinian being almost the top of it, ultra-Plinian is the only thing bigger. Yes? The question is, are there no active vents in Katmai? And the answer is, there definitely are active vents at Katmai. All the volcanoes around the head of the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, there are 7 volcanoes right around there. Only one of them is not active. All the others are active, but it, of course, depends on your definition of the word active. I'm using it to mean that there are active steam vents or fumaroles, something like that, under there. Yes. What do I expect scientists will be studying 100 years from now at Katmai? Wow, that one's really hard to know. There's certainly still more things to learn about, and certainly the things that we try to tackle in change with new kinds of instruments that we can use that do different things. So, for instance, some of the things we've been able to do more recently, say in the last decade, are, for instance, looking at the bubbles that I mentioned. They look at the composition of the gas that was trapped in those bubbles. Well, it couldn't do that not all that long ago because we didn't have the instrumentation to do it. So it's hard to imagine what could happen in 100 years from now, but I would think that technological advances would have a lot to do with it. Yes? The question is, how does this compare with the Kimberlite volcano? I don't know much about Kimberlite volcanoes, but I don't think that they're really explosive. They're deeply rooted, and that's why they often are associated with diamonds, high pressure. Whereas the holding chamber, the magma chamber for this eruption was probably on the order of 3 to 5 kilometers below the surface, which is much shallower than Kimberlites. The question is the lake level still rising? And I believe it is not, and the reason it's not is because it kind of reaches a steady state. The volcano is made up of layers of sort of solid rock and pumice-like layers. And it gets to a certain state where the water just essentially drains out of some of those more porous layers. So I don't think it's rising anymore. So the question is, are there any laws or regulations that prevent the normal person from hiking up to the dome? Well, first of all, it takes a special person to want to do that hike. But aside from that, it's encouraged, and I would encourage you to do it. It's a wonderful place. You do have to come prepared. The weather can be difficult, and you have to cross very cold rivers. There's no way around those things, and of course there are bears. But aside from all the normal Alaskan things, it's a great place to go. I would highly encourage it. I didn't quite get the beginning of your question. Characterize magma chambers? Well, magma chambers are being created all the time, and one of the new technological advances that have been made over the last 10 or 15 years is a kind of satellite imagery that can make an image of the difference in the ground elevation from one year to the next. And we look at these things and you can see the ground either rising or falling. And when you look at these things, well, that's what we do. We go investigate it, but a lot of times it's thought that the reason the ground is rising is because there's new magma coming up from below. So there's magma chambers or dikes being formed all the time, and then there's older ones that are in the process of cooling, like those that are still under Katmai Caldera. Katmai Caldera, the lake in the caldera still doesn't freeze in the wintertime, and that's because there's still residual heat. And then there are, of course, still older ones. So the answer is there's a whole range of magma chambers or holding pots for magma in terms of age.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Judy Feirstein, research geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. She responded to questions from the audience following her talk entitled The Novarupta Katmai Eruption of 1912, Largest Eruption of the 20th Century, A Centennial Perspective. Hosted by the U.S. Geological Survey, the National Park Service, and the Alaska History Society, Judy was recorded speaking at the Anchorage Museum on April 24, 2012. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.